Victoria.
Thank you. There's a little graffito in front of me carved into the table, which you can think about while I'm speaking. Did the devil make the world while God was sleeping? Since we're talking about the crisis, it might be quite pertinent. Well, the paper that I offered for this session is not a real paper in the academic sense. It's actually a sort of extended book prospectus. My purpose is really to get feedback as to whether you think the elements in it are coherent and the basic structure of argument is coherent. And I urge you not to look for carefully sustained chains of reasoning or much data to back up what I'm saying. It's not that kind of paper. We've called it Keynes and the Economics of Enough. Well, Keynes is in there because this is a session on Keynes, Marx, and the crisis. It doesn't have all that much to do with Keynes. It really has to do with the notion of the economics of enough. More grammatically, I suppose, you could call it sustainability or sufficiency, but I kind of like the sound of the economics of enough, because it can be contrasted rather sharply with the economics of excess, which is what we've been living through until it all fell apart. That is, we've been engaging in the economics of excess in the top echelons of the first world economy. The rest has had a rather different story to tell. Now, the financial system's role in the present crisis has been to the forefront of the discussion about the crisis, and the policies to deal with these, with this system, have commanded our immediate attention. But it's the contention of this paper that there are underlying causes which have not commanded so much notice, with the exception of the fifth element that I'm going to outline below. And we identify five things that need discussion. First, a falling rate of profit in the developed world. Second, a widening of income distribution in the developed world. And third, the disparity between the first and third world's prosperity, continuing and even increasing. On account of the first element, the falling rate of profit, it is not surprising that, four, finance, once the handmaiden of industrialization and capitalist growth, became a largely speculative enterprise and is partly a consequence of the apparent success of finance before the crash that, five, financial flows moved perversely from the less developed to the developed world. Well, there are these five elements. The policies of liberalization and globalization, which were thought of in the first world's political discourse as the only way to go, were the engine of these trends. And once the financial system collapsed, all these factors that I've just outlined, once thought of as natural products of the market system, are exposed as the underlying imbalance that have produced the position in which we now find ourselves. So I'm just going to elaborate on these a little bit, and then come to some very rapid-fire conclusions concerning what we might do about it. Before I proceed, I really ought to ask how many of you heard me on Friday. How many people were there? It's about half and half, so I'm afraid there has to be some distribution of suffering. Some of the things I said there, I will say again, for the benefit of those who weren't there, and if it was overwhelming, then I'd skip through the first element of the argument rather quickly. But I can still skip through it rather quickly. The point that I made in the plenary and which forms part of this paper as well, is that I see a difficulty in the first world for firms to find new outlets for investment. And this is something which we should regard as perfectly normal after a sustained period of very strong economic growth and strong investment. Accumulation does bring with it the natural decline in the price paid to scarcity, if you like, unless retrieved by technological change. And there's been quite a lot of technical change, but the great spurt, of course, followed the end of the Second World War, when, again, because of the destruction of capital, the profitability of investment was very high. So it's been declining, sort of slowly and gracefully. And putting a date on it is very difficult. I wrote about it in 78, suggesting that the inflationary spiral which we'd experienced was partly a response to the rate of profit falling in the 70s. Alan, in a very good paper he recently delivered, puts the date around the 80s, describing the dot-com bubble as the last hurrah, really, of an investment boom. And we'll undoubtedly see other bubbles as particular opportunities are focused on. But there is an underlying falling rate of profit, in my view, in the first world. And this I take from Keynes's chapter 17, and you can take it from elsewhere, as you know. But the conclusion is the same. Keynes wasn't alarmed by this prospect at all. He rather favored it. He wrote, "I am myself impressed with the great social advantages of increasing the stock of capital until it ceases to be scarce." A little reflection will show, he goes on, what enormous social changes would result from a gradual disappearance of a rate of return on accumulated wealth. A man would still be free to accumulate his earned income with a view to spending it at a later date, but his accumulation would not grow. He would simply be in the position of Pope's father, who, when he retired from business, carried a chest of guineas with him to his villa at Twickenham and met his household expenses from it as required. So you have a classic stationary state with zero interest on saving and nothing but net investment replacing worn-out equipment. Keynes, as I say, was not alarmed by this because he took economics as a way station to get your life comfortable enough to do better things, and didn't ask the question, and nobody else did either, nor have they since, how is a system with only a normal rate of profit on the existing capital stock and zero interest on saving to be sustained? Now that, to me, is a very important question. As I say, nobody has addressed it. Andy, what was your expression for that yesterday? That it's a problem for the profession as a whole, but you had a lovely phrase, and I forget it. You forget it too. All right. That's life. God was asleep. I mean, but his prediction for capital satiety was that it would happen around about 1961. This was without accounting for war and the things that happened. So he thought it would happen quite soon, and you would have thought he would give some thought to what kind of arrangements were entailed. Nevertheless, what I see is a falling profit opportunity in the first world, and I think this is what was the main spur to the shift from real production to financial production. You know, if you can't make money making widgets, you turn to finance where you can make money out of money or nothing. Anne Pettifer on Friday said, why is everyone concerned with the profit rate? You really ought to be looking at this highly leveraged banking system for the source of our difficulties. She's right, of course. What I'm merely saying is that I think that one cause of the shift to finance, there are others like technology and whiz kids doing capital market pricing of all sorts of weird instruments. But one big cause is that producing widgets isn't as profitable as it once was. So then you get a shift to finance and an explosion of the financial sector and a release of the financial sector from its connection with the real sector through financing real activity. While all this is going on, of course, consumption expenditure becomes the element which is largely financed by borrowing, rather than, as Keynes assumed, investment being the major exogenous variable. Consumption and expenditure on property, I think, should properly be treated then as the exogenous variables of a modern Keynes-inspired approach to macroeconomics. This substitution has interesting roots because capital felt the profit squeeze and reacted by squeezing, weakening the position of labor in the developed world. The Thatcher government in Britain pursued what she called monetarist policies, cutting back on bank lending in order to reduce the money supply, to squeeze inflation out of the system, remember? That she did, actually, but of course the mechanism by which she did it was to create quite a large pool of unemployment. This is, in fact, perfect Keynesian policy with a negative sign. If you want to increase employment, what do you do? Run a government deficit and finance it by new money. If you want to create a reserve army of the unemployed, you do what Thatcher did. It's exactly Keynesian. It's very interesting. I have once seen this point made by Ford, you know, he of the double F's for Ford, in the Bank of England Quarterly Bulletin, of all places. I couldn't find the reference in time. It will reappear sometime in the future, but it is a remarkable place to find this point made. In the US, both the unions and the minimum wage have come under attack. And behind or beyond these local attacks, these national attacks, of course, you have globalization pitting first world labor into competition with cheaper labor in the third world. And this was instrumental to this whole project of grabbing back profits from the wage bill. At the same time, liberalization in financial markets, coupled with the strong anti-inflationary policy I've just mentioned, meant that rentier income also rose while wage income was under attack. So both forms of capitalism, of capital, rather, have gained in relation to labor. Data on the income distribution show this very, very clearly, particularly for the U.S., that the income distribution has become more skewed than steadily up to 2006. And this point, the rise in the maldistribution of income or the inequality of income has given rise to a further point that those at the high end of the income scale are the ones who engage in conspicuous consumption and the purchase of property and other assets that's contributing to asset price inflation. So let me move on to the banking system and just say a few points about that. Again, in pursuit of profit, it's necessary for the banks to expand as rapidly as they did, and the only way that they could do it was to reduce liquidity and to borrow from each other, and it was that immensely fragile institutional or balance sheet arrangement which is at the root of the financial crisis. Very interestingly, one of the papers delivered at this conference, which I couldn't attend yesterday when I was doing something else, refers to a paper by Magdoff and Sweezy written in 1977, which, if you add in derivatives, exactly explains what happened in this crisis. It's quite, quite remarkable, and I urge you to read it. But there were other trends in banking brought on by intensifying competition in line with the kind of market fervor which characterizes the developments since the 70s. Not only did personal loans rise in importance, but banks went into mortgage lending, which they had never done before, because these created too much of a maturity mismatch. This, as I say, was supported by a spate of financial innovation and the determined policy of liberalization. And these contributed to the expansion of the banks, which looked absolutely foolproof until it collapsed like a house of cards. Okay. And then another element, of course, is the inequality of income distribution between the first and the third worlds. The problems I've been discussing are entirely about the first world. And we know that the inequality between the two worlds has certainly not decreased. The disparity persists. And this despite the success of the BRICS, notably China. It's notable, too, that development, particularly in China, has been damaging to the environment. There's nothing new here. We made a mess, too, when we were industrializing, and it's now their turn, so to speak, except that we can no longer afford it, and we now know that. The final element, the capital flows from China, have been blamed by some, including Bernanke, for causing the financial crisis. This seems to me to be completely misguided. He said there was a glut of liquidity, which is not the case at all, leading banks to take the kinds of lending decisions which they did. But the extraordinary thing, of course, from a neoclassical point of view, is the perverse direction of this flow of capital from the third world to the first world. From the standpoint of heterodox thinking, however, it's not so exceptional. It's quite normal for funds to flow from the periphery to the center to gain the extra liquidity advantages of holding a universally accepted currency, backed by oil, as Radhika said half an hour ago. And it's not a surprise that this should happen. Well, now, in a minute, what is to be done about all this? The interesting thing about what we think should be done is that it has many different time horizons attached to different aspects. In the short run, with the crisis on us, the obvious thing is to for governments to spend, but to spend wisely. In Keynes's time, when unemployment was rife and there had been very little investment for years, it didn't much matter what you did. Now, with the climate change and peak oil problems looming over us, we know perfectly well that it matters a great deal what you do, and here is where the Green New Deal comes in. Spending on green projects, sensible spending, from both the point of view of climate change and from the point of view of preventing unemployment. And it gives you a breathing space in which to think about how to bring down the level of first world consumption, because it must come down. The third world can't come up to it. There isn't enough. How to bring down first world consumption to arrive at the economics of enough. I think I'll stop there, actually. I can. I could say more. I always can.
Thank you, Vicky. That's clear.